Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris and I am sick of all these easy books. Today I'm looking for a book that was kind of hard to get through, but maybe kind of rewarding. Very specific. Very hyper-focused. To help me are my friends Ian and Joe, two English teachers.
My name is Joe Holshue. I have an extremely difficult book to get through that is extremely rewarding, Nick. It is Ulysses, written by James Joyce, maybe famous for its challenge.
I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, if you're looking for a challenging but somewhat rewarding book to read, I think you should read The Faerie Queene by Edmund Spenser.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Joe, you really, really, really just went off the reservation there, didn't you?
Really riffing the intro.
Did I say English teacher or no? I don't know if I did.
You did not.
You didn't say any of it.
No one knows who you are.
It's just the script.
Yeah.
You can change what's in red.
You just listen. Obey the script slavishly and you'll be fine.
I feel like I really get mixed messages about this script. I feel like sometimes I'm told to riff and other times I get yelled at for riffing.
You guys are challenged with bringing two books to the table under some guise of a theme. And normally you love them. But I kind of asked that maybe you guys bring something to the table that you appreciated reading, but it was kind of difficult to get through because that's kind of how I view most books. But
wait, so Nick, you wanted us to share our yes. experience of struggling with reading so that you would feel better about your experience with all books.
For the next 3 hours, I'd like to hear about the pain that you went through.
Can I just do a groan?
So I'd like nobody to do else has
like an
to
hour
do it.
And a half long drawn out groan.
No.
Grunting?
So
can I grunt?
Yes. So this week we have Ulysses, the biography of the Southern General and the Faerie Queene.
Gosh, how do you know that little about history? It was the winning Northern General.
The Southern General.
Gosh.
Okay, well.
So, honestly, if we're being honest.
No.
The 19th century.
Ian is going to strong arm his way into going first.
No, I'm
again.
Not.
He always does this.
I want to talk about the name Ulysses. I was just reflecting on the fact that we had a president named Ulysses. And we also had
a president. That's not our president's name.
Now we had one in the past. We also had a president named Millard. So that's pretty great, if you ask me.
I don't understand what you're saying at all.
I'm saying it's pretty crazy that we chose as the head of state an individual named Ulysses.
Why is that crazy?
It's such a freaking weird name.
I feel like Ulysses could make a comeback. That'd be kind of... Nick, you're about to have a child. Maybe you want to name her Ulysses.
Yeah, Nick, I guess...
Little Ulysses.
Our question is, why aren't you going to name your child Ulysses? And is it because you hate the history of America?
Yes.
Wow.
I don't want her to be related with that Southern racist general.
He was a fine gentleman, but he did have a drinking problem.
He did have a drinking problem.
I want to hear more about Ulysses. So, Joe, why don't you go first?
Wait, hang on.
What?
Yeah, here comes
you didn't
the
give me a chance.
Here comes the bullshit.
You didn't give me a chance to strong arm my way into going first.
Sounds like it's happening.
No, I'm not. I just want rules, Nick. I want rules because, like, usually you say to us, what book should I read? And then we say to you should read this book because it has funny jokes or its story is cool or it's 1,300 pages long.
Mm-hmm. I have said all of those things. Yes.
No, we say that to you. We say, like, here's why you should read this book. But I, as much as I appreciate the book that I'm going to tell you about, I don't know that I can in good conscience say, Nick, you should read this. Like, it's not that kind of book.
Well, why didn't you bring me a book that I should read?
Because you told us to bring a challenging book. And this book is
challenging.
So these are challenging. I guess just focus on the good part is that you did take away from it.
How are you going to judge? That's my question. Are you going to judge us based on...
There's no way of knowing that.
All right.
Just like I always judge.
Shooting from the hip, just like Ulysses.
What?
So, Joe, why don't you kick us off with Ulysses in the Odyssey?
Okay. Okay, so, Nick, I guess I need to assess a little background information for you first, okay? And I feel like I'm always starting by quizzing you, but I have another one today.
I do like your questions, Joe.
Okay. What do you know about the Odyssey? Or if I say the name Odysseus, what does that mean to you?
I know nothing.
Okay. Ian, when's the last time you read the Odyssey?
I mean, I guess kind of over lunch today. I sort of read it through once a day. To
you mean
fresh.
Besides the audiobook at lunch? Okay.
Probably within the last 6 months or so.
So Nick, I guess this is something that I missed growing up, you know, so now I'm in a position where I teach the Odyssey every year, but I never read the Odyssey.
He still hasn't read it.
Oh no, I've read it many times now, but I never read it until I taught it for the first time. The Odyssey follows Odysseus, who is the hero in ancient Greece, and he is like the hero of the Trojan War. Nick, have you heard of the Trojan horse?
Yes, I have.
It's a kind of computer virus.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, good. Perfect.
That protects you from STDs.
Okay, so the Trojan horse.
Is this like an explicit podcast?
The Trojan horse, it was Odysseus's idea, right? And in a lot of ways, Odysseus comes away from the Trojan War as the hero, right? He's known for his cunning. And the story of the Odyssey starts when he leaves Troy, and he's trying to get back home to his wife, Penelope. Long story short, he ends up being gone about 20 years between the war at Troy and between getting home to his wife, Penelope. And the stories that he goes, the adventures that he goes on are probably things that you've heard of in the time, right? Or in your time on Earth. So, for example,
on Earth.
Now, yes.
Did you hear
with
this
with my human ears
when you were off Earth?
Hey, Joe, before we get too deep into this, can you introduce your book?
Yeah, absolutely. So
I am
in the process of that. But
give him some space, dude. Gracious.
I'm talking about a book that was not written 2,500 years ago by Homer. I'm talking about a book that was written in right around 1920 by an Irishman named James Joyce. And the book is called Ulysses. And the title itself, Ulysses, is an allusion to Homer, the Odyssey, and Odysseus.
Okay. I'm tracking.
All right. First.
Keep going, Joe.
Yep. I've got some fun facts about the author.
Love it.
Yes. He is Irish.
You already said that.
Very fun. So
that is fun.
It is fun. So James Joyce was born in Dublin, and he kind of had this rowdy Irish upbringing. He was actually like this really good student, but like as a young man, he had kind of this rowdy life. He was, he would fight, he would drink. He met his wife. I have a very specific date for you that becomes important. He met his wife on the 16th of June, 1904, and he met her like out at a bar. She didn't think very
Do
much.
Do I have to remember this date?
There will be a quiz. It also will become important.
Okay. I'm paying attention.
When she first saw him, she at first thought he was a Nordic seaman. He was wearing a sailor's cap. He had sparkling blue eyes. But then she said, as soon as he started talking, I knew him for just another worthless Dublin boaster trying to chat up a country girl. However, according to his Wikipedia page, their first date, they hit it off pretty well. And she, this is Wikipedia's words, not mine, masturbated him that night.
Now, I should let you know that I did change the Wikipedia entry pretty drastically earlier this week. So take everything.
Ian's going to start sabotaging Joe's
everything that Joe says with a grain of salt.
Nick, James Joyce had an eye disease his entire life, but the offshoot.
I'm sorry. Are we still on the topic of fun facts? I have not heard a single fun fact. Is fun.
James Joyce. Nick?
He was Irish and he liked to drink.
He got shot at.
He liked hand gibbers on his first dates.
Nick, he wore an eye patch. He wore an eye patch.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you would like that. Don't you like that?
Was he missing an eye, or did he just wear it for fun?
So,
because if he just wore it for fun, that would be a fun fact. But if he just had some sort of eye, you know, problem,
eye disease, perhaps
it's less fun. It's a little bit, you know, more
he did
serious.
Have eye disease. He did, and he had many surgeries on his eyes throughout his
it's
life.
Just gross.
That's
now.
A gross fact.
He
had a gimp leg and a bad eye.
The last fun fact I have about it, and this part isn't fun, but it's the first part.
As opposed to all the other facts, this one is not fun.
He had a daughter with schizophrenia, and he was concerned about.
Good times.
But he was concerned about it. He wanted to help her, so he brought her to the most famous psychiatrist he could find, a guy named Carl Jung. Carl Jung is a guy that you might have heard of in your lifetime, and sure. He diagnosed his daughter. Like he met with the daughter, he diagnosed her, and he said, "Well, she's schizophrenic." But then, after reading Ulysses, he said, "You know what? I think Dad is probably also schizophrenic." After reading this book that we're going to talk about today,
boo.
So, yeah. So, those are the fun facts about the author. I'm going to move on.
Is this the part where we laugh?
Ulysses follows three characters, and it follows them throughout a single day in Dublin. That day starts at about 6 a.m. and it finishes at about 2 p.m. And every chapter in this book is an hour in that day. If you ask me what happens in Ulysses, it's hard to give much of a description, because pretty much what happens is the main character, Leopold Bloom, walks around Dublin, and he is waiting and trying not to go home because he knows that his wife, Molly Bloom, is going to have an affair that day, and he doesn't want to come home while it's happening.
Oh, so it's like a magic book where you can tell the future?
No, it's like a fun book. These are more fun things that happen.
I didn't say fun. I'm done with the fun facts part. This is the book part.
All right, we're done. Now it's time to the... Okay, so he's trying not to have find his wife sleeping with somebody else.
How does he know? I'm actually curious. I've never read this book. How does he know she's going to have an affair?
Well, the main way that he knows she's going to have an affair is that she has had many affairs before this.
That's one good way to know.
Yeah, she has a history of this, right? And he finds out, he suspects that like today is the day that it's going to happen. And the last thing in the world he wants to do is come home while it's going on. So a huge part of Ulysses is Leopold Bloom walking around Dublin, distracting himself from this thing.
How many times has his wife cheated on him and he's okay with it?
You know, it's, I think Leopold Bloom ends up being, and this is going to be such a hard book to talk about in a short way here, but I think Leopold Bloom is...
Talk faster.
It's a good joke. But Leopold Bloom is like a super average dude. And I think one of the interesting things is, you know, this book is called Ulysses. It is a reference to the Odyssey. And in the Odyssey, we, of course, follow this super epic hero Homer as he's on his way home from Troy and doing all these heroic things. In Ulysses, we follow Leopold Bloom as he proceeds to be like not at all epic, not even a little bit epic. He is... he's
running errands.
Yeah, he runs errands. We see a lot of his thoughts. We see his stream of consciousness. We see him as he visits the cemetery. We see him as he goes to the bank, the pub, as he goes to work. He's,
you know, those errands you usually do, the cemetery and the pub.
Well, those things are often related.
My goodness.
Leopold Bloom, as he goes through Dublin, he is exposed to all of these. You might call him like small humiliations. He is half Jewish, and as such, he's an outsider in heavily Catholic Dublin, Ireland of the early 1900s. He runs into men throughout the day in social settings at the funeral, at pubs, etc., that have slept with his wife, right?
Oh,
and
boy.
He doesn't acknowledge the fact, and he just has like his normal daily interactions with these men.
Man, this guy's life sucks.
Yeah, and it's kind of strange because you're right. His life kind of sucks. There's a moment in it where we get to see the stream of consciousness of Leopold Bloom, and we get to see him as he's thinking. Like, we just watch his mind wander, and it's narrated from his point of view, right? And in that time, he thinks about getting fired. He daydreams. He watches women in the street. He dreams of winning a competition in a magazine. He dreams of owning a cottage by the sea. The stream of consciousness is actually interrupted when he farts, right? And it's like he's supposed to be a not very impressive dude.
Does the book have like those buttons on the side that you press and it's like a fart sound?
Not the version I read, but maybe in one of the annotated versions.
That seems like it would be like a good merchandising option.
Yeah. No, it does have pop-ups, though. It's just like kind of these men, you pull a tab and like these men pop up. And those are men that have also slept with his wife.
This is just like so glum. Like why read this? Why?
You're really driving home the fact here that this is a tough read because it sounds really, really, really boring.
It just sounds like sad.
Yeah,
like,
it sounds sad.
Here's the thing. Part of it is that it is sad. One of the things James Joyce is doing in this book is he's making Leopold Bloom be unimpressive, but also be the hero of this book. And it's a commentary on kind of what it means to be a hero, because Leopold Bloom does nothing heroic in this book. There is never a moment of redemption for him. He doesn't run home at the last minute and sweep his wife up in his arms. He doesn't punch one of these suitors in the face. Like, he doesn't do anything heroic whatsoever, but he still is our point of view character for the vast, vast, vast majority of this book. But I want to talk about the stuff that does make this book famous.
I mean, it's pretty bold to tie yourself to like iconic literature like that, right? Like Ulysses, like it's pretty,
it's aspirational
with how it, well, it's bold.
Well, here's the thing. James Joyce was he was bold. He was absolutely bold. But at one point, somebody told James Joyce later in life that they didn't find Ulysses worth reading. His response was, if Ulysses isn't worth reading, then life isn't worth living.
Oh my gosh.
That's what he said about his own work. His own work. With his eye patch.
What I think about this podcast.
Whoa, hey. Whoa, wait. How does that work? If Ulysses isn't worth reading, then this podcast isn't worth listening to?
Isn't worth listening to, yeah.
James Joyce is very firmly a modernist, and he is trying to write a great work of literature, and he is trying to write a classic. And one of the ways he does this, somewhat ironically, is by breaking away from all of the classic conventions of literature. Mm-hmm. James Joyce tries to do that in text and do that in literature. And he tries to redefine what a book can look like.
So he tries to break from the classic conventions of literature. And he does this by referencing one of the iconic stories from 2,000 years previously. And not just in the title, but in mimicking the sort of style and mimicking the structure, the organization. Is this what you're claiming there?
Oh, no, it's not what I'm claiming. It was incredibly intentional on his part. In a lot of ways, he heavily restricted himself to like certain formal conventions.
Somebody who hasn't read The Odyssey and hasn't read Ulysses, like can you give me an example of like how he had mirrored, you know, a particular situation or scene?
Absolutely. So there's a point when Leopold Bloom is killing time and he goes to the pub and he runs into the Cyclops. Ian, what do you remember about the Cyclops from The Odyssey? You read this recently.
Yeah, he's a giant. He eats people. He has one eye.
Does he have an eye patch?
No, he's only got one eye. Odysseus defeats him by trickery.
Yeah, so in this pub, he runs into Leopold Bloom, runs into a Cyclops. He runs into a man, yes, Nick, with an eye patch. And instead of being this big monstrous being, he is just like a big loudmouth Irish nationalist drunk, right? Like who's like spouting his opinions and like yelling at people in the bar.
Mm-hmm. In no particular direction.
And Leopold Bloom, like he has that encounter with this Cyclops, right? We even get overt references like whereas Odysseus is sailing for 20 years to return home to his faithful wife, Penelope, Leopold Bloom is killing time for 20 hours to return home to his unfaithful wife, Molly, right? So we get parallels in the text like that.
You use the word modernize. Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask, what's the, like, how you're differentiating between modernizing and updating, but really it sounds like the verb you're talking about is making boring and sad. Like, I mean, like, okay, yes, the Odyssey has plenty of problems. It is not a perfect book. It is fun. Like, it's a fun story. It's got, like, great adventure, and there's, like, feats of strength, and, like, the scene with the Cyclops is amazing. And it just seems like, to me, and again, I haven't read this book, it seems like he's taking a pretty cool story, and he's like, how can I make this terrible? The worst.
Yeah, it seems like he's taken these huge, great, just powerful stories and turned them into the mundane.
So I think that's such an interesting observation, and I don't disagree in content. But one of the things he does is James Joyce is really trying to celebrate like the average person's life, right? I think one of the things he's saying is he says, like, look, you are not Odysseus, but you know what? Like,
you have one eye.
Like, you are not Odysseus. You are not an epic hero, but your troubles, your trials, your tribulations, your victories are just as cool, like, are just as important. And, like, your modern life, your average life is heroic in a very modern, in a very small way, I guess.
Okay. I actually kind of like this.
I don't. average people's lives are, like, according to Joyce, maybe not fun, not great.
There's like, there's a famous quote by, can I read you guys a quote?
Yeah.
Please, can I read a quote now? Can I go now?
We've been waiting for 4 episodes. Do it.
All right. So there's a famous quote by Alfred Hitchcock about drama. And the quote is, drama is life with the dull bits cut out. Now, it seems like Leopold has managed to somehow circumvent this core principle in drama, and he has replaced all of the interesting parts of drama with the dull bits. I think it's an interesting concept for a book.
Okay. This is, so I want to say,
what did you actually like about it?
So you've actually just asked me 2 different questions. One is the piece about drama.
No, it was one question.
life is drama with the dull bits cut out, or drama is life with the dull bits cut out. I think Joyce would say that what he has done is he has made heroes and monsters out of everyday Dubliners. And by making this drama happen on a very personal scale, on a very small scale, he has acknowledged the threat that we feel when we go to a bar and the one-eyed Irish nationalist is yelling about his country, right? Like, he has acknowledged that as a monster in our lives.
This is interesting. I like this. I think the mundane things are far more interesting than, like, whatever grandiose shit is going on in the Odyssey. I don't know. It's kind of like why I like Seinfeld. It's just a show about fucking nothing.
James Joyce Ulysses, a book about nothing.
Yeah.
So actually,
what's the deal with the Odyssey?
So you asked me a second question, though, which is, what did you like about it and what was interesting about this? And that is a totally different conversation. James Joyce is very intentionally messing around with language, style, and conventions when he writes this book. And one of the most obvious ways that this manifests itself is every chapter is written in a different theme. Let me give you an example.
Okay.
Chapter 11 is actually my favorite example of this, but I think it's almost impossible to read. Chapter 11, James Joyce writes as if it is a symphony. I think this will illustrate why it is so difficult to read this book, but why it's also very interesting if you're willing to do a little bit of digging. I'm just going to read. So the beginning of chapter 11, I'm looking at that on my screen right now. It is essentially just like a column of words. And if you glanced at this, I think most of these words look like total nonsense, but I'm going to go over it.
Okay.
Bronze by gold, heard the hoof iron, steely ringing. Ipthernium, Thurnthernium. Chips, picking chips off rocky thumbnail chips. I'm going to pause right there because it continues to be nonsense.
Oh my God.
I want to pause.
I want to kind of take back everything I already said about the positive.
Because here's the thing. It's okay. This is my concern, Joe.
You get to talk in a second because I want to talk about this chapter just a bit. Okay. One of the reasons that it's unreadable in the beginning, that you have no idea what's going on in the beginning, is because Nick and Ian, if you've ever gone to a symphony, if you've ever gone to a play and you've heard the pit orchestra warming up, you can hear them all playing their disjointed, small little snippets, and the result is cacophonous, right? The result is just like this mess of small musical interludes. That's what he's imitating.
Yeah, yeah, but then they play together and it's good.
Well,
what?
Later when in the chapter. So yeah, that happens 30 lines later. Then the chapter really starts and it picks up a narrative semblance, and all of those things that I just read show up again in the chapter in context and make sense when you see them again. This is the sort of playful stuff that James Joyce did with language. And I think when I remember the Odyssey, or when I remember Ulysses, I'm sorry, this is the stuff that I remember.
Hmm. So it seems I haven't read this book, and I came into this like eager to be persuaded, because it is one of those classics that everyone talks about. Like, oh, it's art. I got to be honest, it seems pretentious. He's claiming to represent like the beauty or the heroism of normal lives. And he's also claiming to be producing this high art. It seems kind of like maybe he's not very connected to people's normal lives. And he thinks the best way to do this is by, you know, doing a cacophony of syllables. That doesn't seem like, it doesn't seem authentic. It feels like pretentious and
shallow. I don't think it is authentic.
Shallow.
I think
it might be shallow, but does it at all factor in that this was written like 100 years ago? Has this been done before that? Something like this?
I think the word that you could use is gimmicky, right? Like, well, you could look at that and you could say that feels like a gimmick, right? But of course, the first time a gimmick happens, it's unique. It's interesting. The first time we hear an aphorism, it sticks with us because it's true. I would argue there's cool stuff to be talked about as literature. It's cool to celebrate the modern man as heroic, or the common man as heroic. But the thing that I remember all the time is all of these different formats in the chapter, and how creatively and dense and body and funny and like clever and beautiful James Joyce's language can be through the majority of this book.
So that's what you get out of it.
When you ask me, like, when the challenge this week is, hey, bring a hard book to read that is ultimately valuable, right? Like, bring a challenging book that is worth reading. That's what I think of here. I think, boy, I don't think I'd want to read this book again, but I am so happy I read it once.
I think that actually sounds like it could be a fun read if you're in the right mood and you're patient enough. But I feel like that's a book that you are only going to find interesting if you've read The Odyssey. If you haven't, that is going to be a bad book, man.
Oh, I actually want to pause right there, because I disagree. I don't think you have to have read The Odyssey to know a lot about The Odyssey. Like, it is
cultural osmosis. You absorb it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Like, you have seen, you have been exposed to so many ideas, so many themes, so many motifs, so many references to the Odyssey in your life that you have read the Odyssey without ever reading the Odyssey.
Sure. I get that. I just think it would probably be better.
Yeah. So it'd be better.
Can I just add a little bit of like flavor to the sort of mythos of James Joyce?
Mm.
No.
Okay, I'll do it anyway. So, Joe, you're familiar probably, though I would be surprised if you read it, Joyce's next major novel,
yeah.
Finnegan's Wake.
So, tell us about this.
I haven't read it because I'm not crazy, but I know people who study Irish literature, and it's one of these books in Irish literature which is like hugely essential. But it's if Ulysses is hard, apparently Finnegan's Wake is practically impossible. You can't even summarize the plot of Finnegan's Wake. And the people I know who study Irish literature say the only way to read Finnegan's Wake is with a group of specialists, like other Irish literature specialists.
Ooh.
And you read a page a week. And then you come together at the end of the week and be like, hey, so do we know what that was about? And most people were like, I got nothing, but I think this one sentence means this. It sounds like a nightmare, honestly. And yet it's a classic. I mean, that's an accomplishment, right? To write a book that's not so bad. It's not like it's such a crappy book, no one should read it. It's so dense. It's so artistic that it is completely useless. That's a power move. It's a power move by Joyce for sure.
Ian, save us.
Yeah, so this is the most painful book I've ever read. No, it's challenging. It's hecka challenging. It's not easy, but I would say it is quite rewarding, and it can even make you feel good. It can even make you feel kind of rad.
Do you need us to help you get excited about this book? Should we pump you up?
I would love to hear you try. So go ahead. What you got?
Well, okay. So I think I'll put in like some really pumped up music right now.
Yeah.
So let's just pause. I'll put in Jock Jams. No. Let's not sing it. Okay. Don't sing it.
Sorry. We'll copyright
just put
issue.
It, let's just be. No, just everybody be quiet, okay. And then we'll put it in here, and then just imagine that you're getting pumped up, all right? So please be quiet.
So we should be quiet here.
Okay, yep. Okay, so now that we're all ready
to I have pyrotechnics.
What?
Can I set off the pyrotechnics?
Yep, those are perfect for a podcast.
Yep.
Ian, tell us about your book,
okay.
The Fairy Queen.
The Fairy Queen is... I'm gonna get the hard stuff out of the way first, kind of like the downer stuff. Not downer, but the challenging stuff. So it is a long poem.
Mm. Oh God.
Yup. Which is I have the PhD. They can't take it away from me, so I'm okay saying this on the record. That was part of the reason this is hard to get through. Because
that might be one of the worst ways to sell a book I can think of.
It's a long poem. You know, my thought is though, Nick, you have to choose one of these. So it's really
50-50.
It's a long poem, and poems are hard. This is the oldest book we have talked about so far on the podcast.
Whoa.
It was written in the 1580s and 1590s. So it's old, and it's written in not Old English, not Middle English, but in a style which is meant to imitate older English poetry. So it's got some challenges.
What does that even mean
in that regard? Well, as you probably know, Nick, English evolved gradually from its Anglo-Saxon Germanic roots.
Cavemen.
So there was Old English, which is very difficult for like modern. It's a different language, really.
Yeah.
You have to know Old English to read Old English. And then there's Middle English. And Middle English is evolved from Old English and shares a lot of characteristics, but it's similar enough to modern English that you can really kind of get what's sort of going on. So Middle English is evolved from Old English, but you can recognize it. You can recognize most of it. I'm going to say like 75% of Middle English you could understand vaguely if you speak modern English. And then
that
modern
is
English
not a high enough percentage.
No, it's hard. Like this is one of the things I do with my students. Right. Whenever I teach the Canterbury Tales, which are written in actual Middle English, I ask my students, I show them the first like 15 lines and I say, what of this can you get? And they can usually get about 3/4 of it. But then
Ian, when you talk to your students and you're trying to get them excited about a book, do you always start with the worst things first? Is that how you normally sell the book?
I have a whole arc for this argument, dude. You gotta
let me tell you about the worst possible things that happen.
You gotta let it mature. Okay. Modern English is readable by modern speakers of English. And a lot of times things like Shakespeare are considered or called incorrectly Middle English or Old English because they're old and they're written in English. But in fact, this is linguistically, technically modern English. Now, The Fairy Queen is written in modern English, but it's sort of massaged, so it kind of sounds old. So you know how like certain elements of culture try and seem kind of like Old Englishy type. So like you got ye Old English pub, that kind of thing, with that font, that Gothic looking font. And the thing they do.
So there's just, is there extra E's?
Yes.
Just
yes.
Everywhere.
God. They just throw an extra. Like when Edmund Spenser, the author, wants to like make a word seem old, he spells it kind of weird, or he throws an E on the end. And sometimes
that's what I do too.
Both spells it weird and throws an E on the end. So it's great.
If we're talking about gimmicks here, I mean, this sounds like the literary equivalent of like your waitress being dressed up like a pirate at Long John Silver's, right? Like this is like just gimmick after gimmick.
Wait, is he playing it up or was it genuine?
Well, this is the thing.
He's like, pretending.
No, I don't think
is
so.
Is he playing
I think pretense, in order to say something is pretending, it has to slip at some point. There has to be a moment where you're like, oh, I see the real Edmund Spenser and he's just a normie. No, this whole book absolutely leans into this. And it is performative. Like the whole book does this performative poetic thing, leaning into this is old. This is ancient. This is an old story. But this is not just in terms of the language. It's in terms of the verse form. It's in terms of the rhyme scheme. It's in terms of its concept, its ideology, and its characters. So this is a book set at the time of King Arthur. It is a King Arthur story.
Mm, that's cool.
And so sweet. It's got this
sword fights,
knights. Yeah, sword fights, dragons, chivalry, monsters.
So give us the who, what, why, where, when.
Okay, so this is a series. This sets out to be a series of 12 interconnected stories about knights and chivalry. It's designed, according to Spencer, designed to teach English gentlemen how to be better knights. And each book of the story, the poem, tells the adventures of one knight representing one virtue. So it's got these kind of interconnected standalone sections. But at the same time, the poem proposes to tell this huge overarching story about the search of King Arthur for a woman, the queen of the fairies, Gloriana, who he loved and lost. So it kind of sets up this episodic element with each book being a different knight with a different virtue. And it's also got what you might call a season-long arc.
Which is so this really is like the Fairy Queen. So it really is like Canterbury Tales style, like each piece told through a different tale, or Monty Python and the Holy Grail style, like the tale of Sir Lancelot, the tale of Sir Galahad.
You know what? I'm actually really curious. Robin. I've never seen any scholarship linking Monty Python, the Holy Grail to the Fairy Queen, but there might be something. There might be some overlap.
I think you should start. This is the sort of thing that in my classroom, I would just start teaching confidently, right? Like I would just start telling, students that it is for this sure is not a thing.
This is Ian, this is a reading. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Maybe this could be your thesis to get your doctorate.
Okay. Yeah, after they listen to this podcast, take it away. That's how I redeem myself.
It's just
each
an idea.
Book is focused on one virtue. So there's a book of holiness. There's a book of friendship. There's a book of justice. There's a book of chastity. There's a book of temperance, which is like
is there a finite number of virtues? How many virtues exist?
Well, and this is kind of one of the things. Spencer set out, I keep saying the book proposes to do this. It sets out. Spencer set out to do 12 interconnected stories. He only got to 6.5.
Ooh.
What do you mean? Yeah. He only got to
He ran out of ideas.
Well, so he started writing this book, started writing these poems about 20 years before he died. And about 4 years before he died, he published the books 3 through 6. So he wrote it for 10 years and then published 1 through 3. And then 6 years later, 4 through 6, and then around the turn of the 17th century, he did end up dying. So he did not finish it.
Is this a complete book?
Well, so yes and no.
Because it does kind of remind me of Eyes Wide Shut. Like, I don't know. Like, Stanley Kubrick did make that movie, but he didn't finish it. And like, I don't know. Isn't finishing the artwork pretty important?
I would say so.
Don't you think finishing the project is important, Ian, or do you not think that's really important?
I'm going to go ahead and just jump off this podcast right now because I've gone as far as I need to, and it's good enough as it is. Probably it'll be fine. I'm not going to worry about finishing or polishing it off. No, I think that's a legitimate concern. The thing is, they're self-contained. So by the end of each book, he wraps up the story of that book. And we get 6 books. And the last book, the 7th book, which we have part of, he doesn't really start the story. So it doesn't feel incomplete. The only thing that feels really incomplete is, well, 2 things. The story of King Arthur's search for Gloriana. That's a big one. But then there's also like, what about the rest of the virtues? Because he says, I'm going to display the 12 virtues that can fashion a gentleman. And we get
does he list what the 12 virtues are? Like,
what are the 12?
Is there like discussion as to what the untold virtues are?
Wait, what do you mean he doesn't? How would he not list them if they're the themes of the chapter?
But he only wrote 6 of them.
He lists the 6, but he doesn't say. So there is a letter that he writes, which is attached to printed versions of these books early on. Where he says, like, this is what I'm going to do. This is what this book is for. Here's my plan.
Can I jump
overall
in here?
Yeah, please.
All right. So the Catholic Church has four virtues, which, hey, that sounds pretty good. They boiled it down to four. Mm-hmm. Those are
the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, the Holy Spirit are separate.
That's right.
So there's four. Aristotle has 12.
Yeah.
And Marcus Aurelius has 14. So he's the most virtuous.
Yeah. It sounds like there's a lot of pollution in the virtue space. It seems like there's a real opportunity for somebody to streamline this system.
Yeah. Well, the Catholic Church did.
I found what Spencer says about this.
Okay.
He says, I have tried to portrait or to depict in the character of King Arthur, before he was king, the image of a brave knight perfected in the 12 private moral virtues as Aristotle hath devised, which is the purpose of these first 12 books, which if I find to be well accepted, I may perhaps be encouraged to frame the other part of politic virtues in his person after that he came to be king. So we're not just talking about 12 here, which are the 12 Aristotelian virtues. We're talking about another 12 after the original 12, where
24 total.
24, and he got through six. So a definition of biting off more than you can chew. Yeah. And people ask him, can you tell us what virtues these are? And he says, nope, just read my book. Read my book when it comes out, and I'll tell you that there you'll find what the 12.
Sign up for my newsletter.
You got to buy the book.
Exactly. It's like sign up for my newsletter, and then after six issues of the newsletter, it stops forever. So.
Wow.
Yep.
I'm glad you got your quote done, Ian, because you're not going to be reading another one. Ian.
Yep.
We've clearly listed out the terrible, terrible things that happen in this book and what makes it so terrible. What are the good things? Tell us about the positive things. Let's get it positive.
Well, I've already started, but I can continue.
You have?
Yeah. It's got knights. Okay. It's got knights. It's got sword fights.
Okay,
it's got monsters, dragons, King Arthur. King Arthur, basically every time he shows up in this book, he just wrecks shop. He just, whatever situation these knights, the main characters of these stories, find themselves in, they usually end up kind of having trouble. Sometimes they get captured. Sometimes they're overcome or deceived. And then Arthur just rolls up and he's like, never fear, it's me, Arthur. And then he destroys whatever the problem is and says, all right then, goodbye. And they continue to succeed in whatever they're setting up.
So each chapter is very much its own story, but there's an overarching story that involves King Arthur.
So the stories are self-contained. Yes.
Okay.
And they're focused on a particular virtue. So the first book is about holiness as a virtue. The next book is about temperance, which is basically the virtue of being chill, the golden mean.
There's a virtue of Netflix.
Okay. These characters kind of do show up in other books. It's a little bit like a cinematic universe today, where
sure,
you can expect to see characters kind of like popping up, weaving in. There's even a really cool moment at the beginning of the second book where your main character, the Red Cross Knight, who is sort of a representation of St. George, the patron saint of England, he's just finished killing a dragon. St. George kills a dragon. How classic St. George right there. And then the next book begins, and he gets in a fight with another knight. And then it turns out the other knight is our main character for this next book.
Oh,
and so there's kind of like a
cool
handing of the baton. There's really a sense that these are an interconnected whole. It's not just that Arthur always shows up to save everyone's bacon when he has to, when they're in trouble. It's also that these characters are existing in the same shared universe, which, I mean, for a book being 430 years old, that's kind of rad. Like, that's kind of rad that 430 years ago, this guy had an idea to say, I'm going to tell a story about superpowered dudes fighting evil.
So I have a question, Ian. So yes. I'm pretty sold. Like as you explain this, I'm not familiar with this at all, but as you explain this, I really do picture a comic book universe, right? Like, I see these people stepping into each other's panels. I love the narrative device of like handing off the baton. But you, of course, Ian, like, you're familiar with Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, it really feels like Arthur Ex Machina here, isn't it? Like he comes in to save the day.
What this book is really good at is taking conventions, setting up conventions, so you expect a certain thing. And then just when you've come to expect it, it troubles them. It turns them on their ear. So Arthur doesn't always show up to save the day. By the time you've been conditioned to expect him to show up, there's a book, one of the books, where he doesn't. Just when this book, like when you settled into it, you settled into the rhythm, like, ah, okay, here we go. There's going to be this. There's going to be an inciting incident. There's going to be a quest and there's going to be a fight at the end. Nope. It gets turned on its head.
Right. So it sounds like he's playing out, like he's playing on that structure. He's playing on that theme, like we were talking about before, where he starts, like he starts being, I guess, playful inside of the structure that he has set for himself.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And he even like plays with this idea of the didacticism, the virtue. So one of my favorite moments in the whole book is the second book. The main character is a guy named, I'm not going to tell you his name because I have a game. Anyway, the main character.
Wait,
We'll play the game in a second. I want to finish this first, and then we'll play the game.
We'll play the game in a second.
We'll play the game in a second. So this main character, he's supposed to be embodying temperance, which is, like I said before, being chill, hitting the golden mean, not too kind of lackadaisical, not too impetuous, just being very wise, hitting that median.
Not to dullness, drink not to elevation.
Yes. What's that from?
Ben Franklin. What? Temperance is Ben Franklin's number one virtue.
Heck yeah. Yeah.
There's been so many references and quotes to old dead people in this episode.
Welcome to Lit. You shouldn't have started a podcast called You Don't Know Lit talking about literature if you don't want to talk about dead people. Anyway.
That's true.
There is a moment when this dude who is supposed to embody temperance, he is supposed to be showing us how to be temperate. He goes into this garden. It's called the Bower of Bliss. And he sees everyone just having a really horny time in this garden. It's like really,
the Bower of Bliss.
Yeah.
I feel like
spelled B-L-I-S-S-E because
I feel like we should start a strip club called the Bower of Blissy.
Oh, it's great. It's great. So he goes into the Bower of Bliss.
There's already a strip club called the Fairy Queen. So.
Okay. He sees his enemy. He sees the big bad he's been chasing all book. And what he does is the least temperate thing. You would expect the Knight of Temperance to be chill, right? To be like, hey, you are intemperate. Here, let me show you the wisdom of being temperate. No, this dude hulks out. He tears off his shirt. He gives like the thumbs down, the gladiator style thumbs down, and he just destroys everything. He explodes the Bower of Bliss. He tears it apart. And the book itself is even like, dude, you're not being very temperate here.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't care. Kill, kill, kill. Stop. Explode. And the thing is, the crazy thing is this garden is presented in this kind of beautiful
crazy
place.
Crazy thing is he turns green.
Yeah. So that's the obvious reference here. This is Bruce Banner saying, I'm always angry. That's my secret, right?
This is the thing. He has been striving to actually legitimately embody this virtue.
In every chapter, are all the main characters just struggling with whatever the virtue is, or are they like personification of the virtue?
So they're supposed to personify the virtue. Each chapter, you have your main character, and they're supposed
to. They all just fail.
They don't. This is the thing. Oh, okay. So the Knight of Holiness struggles but overcomes.
So as you describe this, Ian, there's something about like the structure. It makes me feel like. I don't know. I don't feel settled. I don't feel grounded when I listen to this. It doesn't feel purposeful.
Right. Well, and this is one of the big questions that people have about this. Like, to what extent did he plan? We know that he was working on this for 20 years. So this was kind of a life's work. It feels like Spencer is developing something. The problem is, because it's unfinished, we cannot see the whole grand design. We can't see the whole chain. It's like when you watch a TV show, like, you know, I'm trying to think of a good example. A good TV show, kind of lore heavy maybe, it gets canceled. Deadwood. Here's a good example. The series Deadwood.
Deadwood. There you go.
Like, you feel like Deadwood is like building, right? You feel like Deadwood is developing towards like even more levels, heights of brilliance. And as you watch farther along, it feels more and more deliberate. And then it gets canceled and we're like, well, okay, we don't know.
Firefly is another example of this. It seems like it's building towards stuff. 2x2, Hands of Blue, and Simon's on the Run. All this stuff is building towards something, but then it gets canceled. And so while we can see...
I actually think we can, not knock on wood here, but I think we're probably going to be able to include Game of Thrones on this in the next couple of years, because there's no way that show's finishing. The books,
hang on to the hope there. This book, we have the promise of structure. We have the promise of a grand design. We even can see the grand design starting to work itself out. But we don't have the disappointment of seeing season 8, where things collapse, where the Night King dies super fast.
We can't be obnoxiously harsh on it because it hasn't properly finished, is what you're
exactly.
saying. So, Ian, what do you like about this book? Is it that it's a fun read? Does it make you think differently about all of the different virtues? And
no.
The didacticism, what do you like about this?
The didacticism has not aged well. What I like about it is a lot of times in Arthur stories, Arthur is not the main character. He's not the really cool dude.
He's like the mystic behind the scenes guy.
Yeah, he's sort of like off to the side. He exists to pull the sword out of the stone and then be king while Lancelot has fun with his wife. But in this story,
funny that you say that. Exactly. I was pretty surprised when you said he's like the one kicking down doors and actually slicing dudes up.
He's great. Like, we actually get to see Arthur. Every time he shows up, it's like, all right, here we go. Like, finally.
Here comes Arthur.
There is actually a robot. One of the first academic papers I presented at a conference was about this robot.
One second. When you say there's a robot in this book, do you mean that there's a robot in this book? Like, is that you like taking artistic license?
No, dude. It is a man made of metal. He is created by a magician. So maybe technically he might be a golem, not a robot. But he has programming. So he is like designed to fulfill the tenets of justice. And so he just goes into situations where there's monsters. He goes to fight a whole bunch of like rabble peasants who are rebelling against their king. And the robot just goes in and
punches
everything to death.
So he's a robot, or he is like an enforcer of the state, right? Like
he's an enforcer of justice.
He's a union buster.
The thing is, like this
is
book,
wild.
The book five, which is the Book of Justice, book five kind of questions how just it is for punitive, what it's called lex talionis, a punitive law.
What?
The law. It's a Latin word. It's law of force, the rule of force, where justice is dispensed as punishment. Mm. And the book doesn't just say, hey guys, if there's people who are criminals, they should be killed. It presents us this character doing this, and it presents it in such an extreme way that we have to ask ourselves, are we actually cool with this? Like, are we okay with Talos, the robot, going in and punching a whole bunch of peasants to death?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's weird that, okay. I mean, normally, like, if there's a book like this, somebody would write in a character who is, like, the absolute, right? So like the absolute virtue, like come to life, and like, you know, they play with that, right? Or whatever it is. But this book seems to have just inserted a robot, which is fucking wild.
It's a statement about the nature of justice, and especially punitive justice, that no human being can fully embody justice. It is impossible for a human being to be a pure embodiment of justice. Justice has to be this inhuman, extra human, superhuman robot.
Mm.
Do you guys want to play a game?
Yes.
Thank God.
Okay. Yes. So this game is called Household Cleaner or Character in Edmund Spenser's Epic Poem, The Fairy Queen.
Fantastic.
So I'm gonna give you a name. It might be a brand of household cleaner, or it might be a character from The Fairy Queen.
Hey, Joe, just a pro tip. If there's like a bunch of E's at the end, it's a character.
Hey, yeah. So I have a question. Is there a form for this? Do we just shout it out? Do we ring in? Do we shout out?
We're going to shout it out.
Yeah. Okay. Shout it out.
Just yell as whoever's louder.
Here we go.
Got it.
Jelmar.
I think it's a character as well. I think he's a bad guy.
It's not. It is a household cleaner.
Oh, is it a bad household cleaner?
What is it clean?
I cannot. I can neither confirm or deny its
effectiveness.
That's a different podcast, Joe.
That is a different podcast. Also, we're not sponsored by Gelmar today.
Exactly.
Neither sponsored by Gelmar nor Gelmar's. Not yet.
If this show gets sponsored by household cleaners, I will be shocked.
I won't.
But I think we could see we could naturally fit it in. Character. Here's another one. Or sponsor.
Here's another
I have
one.
A game for you guys. Here, Audible. Who's Audible? Do you think that's a character or you
started,
a sponsor?
You started off this podcast by saying, I don't think audiobooks are books. So that ship has sailed. Here's another one. Britomart. Britomart.
Oh, this feels like a tricky one. It feels like you want us to say, household cleaner so bad. I'm going to go ahead
it
and
sounds
say character.
Like you clean it. You clean a window with it. I'm gonna
it sounds
go
like you clean
say,
a supermarket with it.
Okay. I'm going to go cleaning product.
Is that your final answer? What do you, would you say, Joe? You said character?
I said character.
Yeah, it's a character. This is the Knight of Chastity.
Britomart.
Britomart.
Is the O in the middle of his name surrounded by hyphens like Bob O-Matic?
No. No, it's not. Here's the last one. Last one. Arm and Hammer.
Arthur Hammer.
That's it. That's the game. You guys, I think you lost.
Both of us?
Joe, I think you won this week just because Fantastic. You really played to my strength of
eyepatch.
Probably liking the mundane more than most people. Mm. So for somebody who I got a lot of reading ahead of me, I think I would want to read
That's
the
optimistic.
Odyssey. Yeah.
I will be doing this reading.
I can't imagine that being readable without having already read the Odyssey, regardless of how much pop culture references I may know already or Odyssey references I may know already through.
Yeah.
I
think that's legitimate. I also think I cannot imagine reading this personally without annotations, without heavy annotations. I think there's just too much. It is too dense.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
too much.
I guess that could be a solution too.
Yeah. But yeah, so I do have a quote to go out on.
Wait, hang on.
Wait,
so,
hold on. Hey, what?
So Joe won because his book was worse?
No, because
Joe won
celebrates
because
the
mundane.
Interest.
Yeah.
And, this was not defined. This is not defined at the top. You said your
Get
book
fucking
won.
Fucking used to it.
You said your book won, and then you told all the reasons why it was terrible.
That is spoken like somebody who is down 1-3 in this series.
All right, so what I liked about Joe's book is that it is super old, but found a way to rethink classic literature and completely think outside the box. I think that's really interesting.
All right. I think I've got a good one for you, Nick, because you said that one of the things you liked about Ulysses is the mundanity, how it celebrates the mundane. It makes a hero out of the everyday character, right? This is a quote.
Give me a quote about like toilet paper or something.
Yeah. So this is a quote from Ulysses. And one time, well, I'll just read this quote. Every life is in many days, day after day. We walk through ourselves, we meet robbers, ghosts, giants, old men, young men, wives, widows, brothers in love, but always we are meeting ourselves. Thank you.